Guardian Unlimited.
Guardian Unlimited podcasts in association with Zurich. Visit guardian.co.uk/Zurich Futurology to join the debate on how the world is changing and for your chance to win a Wi-Fi laptop.
Hello, I'm Alok Jha, and this is Science Weekly from Guardian Unlimited, your indispensable and quite frankly unmistakable guide to the worlds of science and technology. Now, where's my music? Good God, do we have a podcast for you this week? Forget everything you've ever heard about intelligent design. This is going to be your final word. Is it really an insightful challenge to evolution, or is it a load of old bunkum? How will it impact your children's education? Does God have any place in the classroom at all? We'll be speaking to experts from the UK and America on both sides of this philosophical divide. And if all that sounds a bit too heavy for you, don't panic. We've also got news about the latest evidence of life on Mars, and we'll tell you where you'll find the sexiest sounding birds on the planet. In case you're in any doubt, this is Science Weekly from Guardian Unlimited. I'm sitting in a packed pod this week. The effusive James Randerson, the elusive Bobby Johnson, and the reclusive Nell Bowes from Guardian Unlimited's arts blog. Guys, make some noise.
Hello.
Now, are you sitting comfortably? Good, we'll begin.
I sometimes wonder why anybody talks about anything else, because this is the most interesting topic there is. Where do we come from? How did we get here? What brought us into existence? What is our relationship to reality as a whole?
The incredible diversity and complexity of life. And inevitably the question arises, what brought all this into existence? Was it simply chance and necessity, undirected natural forces? Or is there something else going on? Is there a purpose, a plan, a design? I think that is the fundamental question.
That was a clip from Where the Evidence Leads, one of the DVDs sent out to every state school in Britain in September by the privately funded group Truth in Science. They want intelligent design to be taught in every school alongside evolution lessons. James, tell us first, what is intelligent design?
Well, the idea is that you can use the scientific method to look for evidence of a supernatural designer in nature. Now, one key notion here is this idea of so-called irreducible complexity. The idea is that something like an eye or the intricate molecular motors that drive the tails of bacteria are irreducibly complex. Now, that means that if you take one piece away, say one of the proteins in the drive shaft of the motor, it doesn't operate anymore. Now, they would say that this is evidence that the thing could not have come about by gradual natural selection. And most scientists say that that's simply an argument based on current scientific ignorance. If we can't understand something, then, well, you don't really have to bother investigating further because you can simply assume that the thing was the work of the designer.
And schools are actually teaching this?
Well, apparently so. Last month, The Guardian revealed that 59 schools had sent feedback to Truth in Science saying that their DVDs were, quote, a useful classroom resource. Now, it's not entirely clear how these things are being used, but we did speak to one science teacher who said his school planned to use them to set up intelligent design as an alternative to evolution. I spoke to Dr. Richard Buggs, who has a PhD in plant evolution and is on the group's scientific panel. I asked him what the group was trying to achieve.
Well, Truth in Science is seeking to have intelligent design and criticisms of Darwin's theory of evolution taught in science lessons. Now, it's quite true to say that intelligent design is not a new argument at all. That's what Dawkins was writing against in The Blind Watchmaker. And indeed, that's what Darwin was writing against in The Origin of Species. So no, intelligent design's not at all new. The debate of whether mind or matter came first is a very old one. And certainly we would like to see this old debate taking place in the science classroom.
What do you say to those who say, well, the problem with intelligent design from the point of view of putting it in a science classroom is that it invokes unnatural causes, supernatural causes indeed, and that just isn't what science does?
Well, intelligent design is simply an inference from the organised complexity of the world that it must have a designer. Now, in this week's issue of Nature, there's a very interesting paper analysing some rusty, corroded old cogs that were found on the floor of the Mediterranean in 1901. and these were part of a mechanical calendar. And there's a fascinating paper that analyses these and reconstructs what the calendar looked like. And really, that's an intelligent design paper. The assumption is that this mechanism was purposefully built. And that's what we're seeking to do with the natural world. We're seeking to infer that it was designed and study it as a design system. And I think there could be real advances for science if we did that.
Who designed the intelligent designer?
Well, that's a philosophical argument, and so that's outside of science. So that's something to be discussed in RE lessons. RE lessons are the place to think about the identity and origin of the designer.
Truth in science, indeed. James, bring on some of your scientists.
Well, I spoke to Professor Simon Conway Morris, who is a paleontologist at Cambridge University and a practicing Christian, and I asked him, is it right to teach this so-called controversy between evolution and intelligent design to school children?
Well, very broadly, I think there's nothing to teach. I mean, intelligent design is simply a hypothesis, which isn't even a hypothesis. I mean, it's something which is devoid of any scientific merit, any scientific proof, any way in which you could go about testing it. It's presupposing a particular view of the universe, which is ultimately theological, and my own view of intelligent design in particular. And I understand that some people in Truth in Science would not describe themselves necessarily as espousing all aspects of intelligent design, but by and large, it seems to me that the problem with intelligent design is actually theological rather than scientific. But anybody who says it's got anything to do with science, I think, utterly misunderstands what science is, and in the point of Darwinian evolution, they utterly misunderstand what evolution's meant to be about. Sorry, rather blunt answer.
Is it really a new idea? Because it's often dressed up in these new terms of irreducible complexity and, you know, saying, well, Darwin didn't know about molecular biology and this is a new idea, but does it really differ from the creationist arguments of old?
Well, not so far as I'm aware. Of course, the famous example of irreducible complexity is this thing called the bacterial flagellum, which is a tiny molecular motor which propels a bacterium, and it's a near miracle of biological design. And of course, I use words like miracle and design, and everybody pricks up their ears. But on the other hand, what we do know is several things. First of all the time in evolution, proteins, which of course build this molecular motor, are used for one function in one place and are co-opted for a completely new function. And there's already some evidence for that in these molecular motors. The other thing, which is rather less well known, is in point of fact that the molecular motor has evolved not once but at least twice completely independently. So you have to say, well, this is a very funny sort of God who sort of gets a design absolutely perfect and then suddenly has another design on the block, because after all, if you've got it so beautifully designed as you see in some bacteria, then surely that would be the design you'd see everywhere. But the very fact that you come to a very similar solution, as we call it, this is something referred to as evolutionary convergence, in another group of bacteria, again, is exactly what we'd expect from the point of view of evolution and exactly what we'd not expect from intelligent design.
So the old argument that, you know, the eye is incredibly complex, indeed perhaps irreducibly complex, they might argue, is the same when it comes to molecular machines or any other products of evolution?
I think that's absolutely right, and moreover, nobody, I think, these days would use the eye as an example of irreducible complexity. We know perfectly well how eyes evolve, and the wonderful thing about the eyes, amongst other things, of course, is that they must be transparent. And to be transparent, and again, biologically, that's absolutely extraordinary, they have to use particular proteins, they're technically called crystallins, that's a sensible name. We know that those crystallins have been recruited from many, many different groups of organism, and previously, in these primitive organisms, long before an eye ever evolved, these crystallins were used for a completely different purpose. And the reason they're used in the eye is simply because they are, if you like, pre-adapted for this extraordinary function whereby they are very stable, rather small, somewhat soluble in water, and those are exactly the structures you need to build a lens in an eye. So any part of the eye which we look at is clearly the product of evolution, and one has to be very wary that some things from a scientific perspective are admittedly difficult to understand completely, like the bacterial flagellum motor. But on the other hand, the problem with intelligent design is as and when we fully understand the origin of the flagellum motor, and we are well on our way, it's not a complete understanding, then that gap will close. And I think from a theological viewpoint, you don't want to be on such a sticky wicket. There are completely different arguments, and they don't seem to understand them.
We're joined in the studio by Professor Lewis Wolpert of University College London. He's also Vice President of the British Humanist Association. Lewis, thanks for joining us. Advocates of intelligent design say it's a legitimate scientific challenge to evolution. Why not just throw in both into lessons and let the kids decide?
I think that the whole argument about intelligent design is bizarre. First of all, I want to approve of everything that Simon Conway Morris has just said. But intelligent design, the idea, has nothing to do with science whatsoever. It's simply a way of promoting evolution and God in schools. Those people who are interested in intelligent design aren't the slightest bit interested in evolution. All they're interested in is getting more religion into schools.
I mean, there's the traditional argument of creationism, where God created the earth, but intelligent design proponents will say that that's not the same thing as intelligent design at all.
Intelligent design is the most unintelligent thing I have come across in recent years. It explains absolutely nothing. But they're not interested, the intelligent designers, in explaining something. What they're interested in is slipping religion into schools in this particular way. It explains nothing, absolutely nothing.
Nell, you seem to be brimming with something to say.
I just wondered if it explains absolutely nothing, then why are we even allowing it the dignity of discussing it now? Isn't it something that we can just ignore?
Well, we have to. I would like to ignore it, but these people are putting these DVDs into schools, and somehow, I mean, the suggestion that the children can decide whether it's there or not is bizarre. I would have thought that the level of competence of children at school understanding evolution was very, very low. Evolution's a very complex process. It involves genes, it involves development, it involves molecules, and I'm terribly sorry, it's not something that school children can deal with at that particular level.
Lewis, you've just published a book, Six Impossible Things Before Breakfast, which is about belief. Creationism, intelligent design, the belief in God. How does that fit with your thesis?
Well, it fits with religious belief. Once you're religious, then you need to assign certain powers to God. But the evidence for God, to put it mildly, is very, very poor. People say, oh, yes, the Bible provides evidence for God, to which I say, can you tell me something that God's done in the last 2,000 years, that is, since the Bible was written? And I'm afraid I get very poor answers.
Well, thanks, Lewis. We'll hear more from Lewis later on in the programme. We'd also love to know what you out there in Podland have to say on this. Is there anything intelligent about intelligent design? Have your kids been shown the Truth in Science DVDs? Send us an email to science@guardian.co.uk or post a comment at blogs.guardian.co.uk/science. And watch out for our Creationism podcast extra that includes more from Simon Conway Morris, Richard Buggs and others. I'm Alok Jha, and you're listening to the Creationist special of Science Weekly. Still to come, God may bless America, but how does the creationist debate play out on that side of the pond? Plus, why lefties may not be quite so sinister after all. We'll be paying tribute to the most gifted left-handers in history. But first, it's time for News Jam, or should I say... News Jam! Yep, this is the News Jam, our fast and furious look at the other stories making the science headlines this week. Spot the difference between this and this. Bobby, tell us what we've just been listening to.
That was the difference between an urban great tit and one in the countryside. Now, apparently, according to some research that came out recently, there is a difference between urban birds and ones in rural areas. The urban birds sing faster, shorter songs at a higher frequency than their country bumpkin cousins.
They're rapping. Some people.
Yeah,
say.
It's
urban
grime,
rapping.
I think grime.
Grime.
That's what we'll call it. Researchers at Leiden University in the Netherlands looked into this, and they examined the songs of great tits in 10 European cities, including London, Prague, Paris and Amsterdam. Then they went around and looked at the birds in the forest as well, and came up with the differences.
So what does this mean? Does it mean that these birds are about to become different species or something?
The main conclusion they came up with was that, you know, in cities the birds have to kind of compete against more things, and lower frequencies don't necessarily work so much. But they also did suggest that perhaps this might be the first step in speciation.
Right, enough about birds. James, the universe may not be such a lonely place.
Yes, these stories about probes finding evidence for water on Mars feel like an old friend to us science journalists. We've all written them three or four times in the past. But this time, NASA's Mars Global Surveyor satellite has found something, well, quite astonishing, actually. It's evidence for water, running water on the surface of Mars in the last 5 years. Essentially, they took one image in 1999 and another in 2005, and there was a change between the two, and what looked like water that had burst out of the side of a valley and you know, run down the valley and then evaporated because the pressure's so low.
Does that mean there's life?
Well, it's tempting to speculate that it might, because, you know, the key ingredient for extraterrestrial life is you know, liquid water. We've got all this evidence of you know, frozen water at the poles, but no evidence before of liquid water on Mars.
A quickie just to the end of that one. NASA's plans to get to the moon. There's a space station going to be up there. There's going to be all sorts.
Well, they say there's going to be a space station by 2020, a permanent base on the moon, but...
you don't sound convinced, do you? No, okay.
Well, we'll
do a podcast from there if it happens. Nell, just finally, tell us about a hero of science who's apparently fallen from grace.
Well, I'm not sure he has. This is the story that The Guardian wrote last week about Richard Doll, the man who proved the link that smoking causes cancer. And some evidence came to light that he was, at the same time as finding and or investigating various chemicals relation to cancer, he was also being paid consultancy fees by various chemical companies. And so there's been a bit of kerfuffle about whether the fact that he didn't find links between chemicals and cancer was related to that.
So this is one of those older debates, isn't it, about whether we should declare interests when, well, scientists should be declaring interests when they're publishing work. Lewis, what's your thought on this? I mean, you've read the story about Richard Doll. What do you make of it?
You know, one just doesn't know. I mean, he made a major, major contribution in relation to smoking and cancer. I just don't know the story about the chemicals. I think it is a problem, but scientists certainly should declare their interests. And I think that every effort should be made that if you do have an interest, particularly in relation to some industrial concern, and you're writing a scientific paper, you must declare that interest.
James, do you think it compromises people?
Potentially it can, but to sort of speak in Sir Richard's defence, and, you know, He's not here anymore to defend himself, to be fair. He was working in a day when, you know, the kind of more rigorous rules that are around today about declaring interests like that were not as routinely in place. And so it probably wasn't unusual for people to have been working in an industry and consulting on an industry at the same time. So it may be a little unfair judging him by today's standards, I think.
Agreed, and I don't think anyone really wants to bash Richard Doll, but it is a good chance to get back into the debate and also to think about or try and measure how much effect a conflict of interest has on your judgment.
Well, there was an interesting study actually done a few years ago which suggested that even we were talking about now people making their conflicts of interest heard, and some researchers looked at 3,500 medical journal reports, and only 2% of them, less than 2% of them, actually declared their interest. So it's not even happening now, and even in our enlightened times.
Undoubtedly, it should happen more than it does. But
And there's a big push to it in the States at the moment.
Okay, well, we'll leave that one there. Just quickly to end this news jam, hands up, who's left-handed?
It doesn't really work on podcasts.
Well, wait, because apparently a new study from Australia's National University shows that if you're a lefty, mate, which Lewis is apparently, you've got better motor and visual skills. It also means you can think quicker when playing sports and computer games. Apparently there's more statistics, Bobby. Who's left-handed?
I've got some lovely, fascinating lefty facts. Left-handers adjust more readily to seeing underwater. Some other stats. 1 in 4 Apollo astronauts were left-handed. That's 250% more than the normal level. And 4 out of 5 original designers of the Macintosh computer were left-handed.
3 of the last 4 American presidents left-handed.
It's Johan Cruyff.
That didn't come
Jimmy
in
Hendrix.
That useful for
Jimmy
Johan Cruyff. Yeah.
How do we know Jack the Ripper was left-handed? That's
I think
what it
was
on this list.
Have you never seen CSI? It's the way
it's the way you stab.
They stab. Yeah.
Also, the most famous Jedi himself, Luke Skywalker, or at least the actor who played him, Mark Hamill, was left-handed. Because of that, we're in a pre-Christmas state of mind. There'll be a fantastic prize. The first listener who can correctly answer this question. You ready? Which hand does Luke have lightsabered off by Darth Vader in The Empire Strikes Back? Your answers, please, to science@guardian.co.uk. So you had a bit of the good, the bad and the ugly in the news jam this week. But this is our creationism special, so let's get back to business. We've heard from both sides of the argument from experts here in Britain, but creationists are much more active across the pond, and the land of the free is never too far from a lawsuit. James, tell us more.
Well, in the US, the intelligent design issue came to a head last year in September in the small rural town of Dover, Pennsylvania. A group of parents there challenged the Dover Area School District's decision to include intelligent design in the school science curriculum. Now, the judge found in favour of the parents, which was all the more surprising since he was a conservative who'd been appointed by President Bush. And in his summing up, he said, "Intelligent design is a religious view, a mere relabeling of creationism and not a scientific theory." Earlier on, I spoke to Dr. Eugenie Scott, Executive Director of the National Center for Science Education. Now, they're a group set up in the US to counter attempts to teach creationism and intelligent design as science. I asked her what tactics advocates of intelligent design are now adopting.
I have a feeling that the intelligent design proponents are looking for a Dover in a different judicial district where they might find a more favorable judge, with the intent that, well, okay, we lost in the Middle District of Pennsylvania, but you know, here we're going to try to win in state X, whatever state that would be, and then we'll have one for you, one for us, and then we'll go to the Supreme Court to try to get a decision. So the legal situation is very different here compared to what you have there. One thing that we have noticed that I think is something that you're not there yet. You may down the line have this problem, but I don't think you have this problem yet, and that is the repackaging of creationism and intelligent, of traditional creationism and intelligent design creationism, as just the weaknesses of evolution or the evidence against evolution. I see a little bit of that in some of the things that I've read about your problem in Great Britain, but I think even if you are a religious person and even if you would like the idea that religion could be manifested in science, it's simply is not the case with intelligent design. It is very clearly a masquerade of a religious view that's just been gussied up into in a lab coat, so to speak. It simply is merely a sectarian religious view, which, according to our First Amendment, you cannot present in the public schools.
What do you think the chances are that they will appeal that case and try and take it to the Supreme Court?
They can. The losing side appeals. And the losing side was of course, the school board. But the school board was completely replaced in the next election. And the winning school board had no stomach to make an appeal whatsoever. And I, as much as I would have loved to have seen this case be appealed, because it was such a strong case, and clearly we would have prevailed at the appeals court level.
I know that you've seen the recent Guardian story about the number of schools apparently using intelligent design teaching materials put about by the organisation Truth in Science. Do you have any kind of advice for people over here who are not happy to see those materials being used in science lessons?
Well, I guess, first of all, I have to say I'm sorry, because these are American exports. The videotapes and I'm sure the written material that the British creationist group is presenting were produced here in the United States by the Discovery Institute, which is the intelligent design think tank up in Seattle. The authorities there who are concerned about what's being taught to British school kids need to consider that this is very bad education, regardless of whether it's the imposition of a religious idea, because you do have, you know, a different relationship between the church and state in your country than in mine, regardless of whether it's okay to present religious views in school. This is just really bad science that you should not be miseducating your students with. I think you might consider how science teachers are prepared, because a science teacher should know enough about the nature of science and know enough about the science of evolution to be able to look at those materials and say, this is bad science. This is not something that I want to use in my classroom. And if teachers are looking at that and saying, wow, I didn't know evolution was such a weak science, that suggests that maybe you might want to spend a little bit more time preparing your teachers in the nature of science, in the epistemology of science, and teach them more about evolution. That certainly is our problem in the United States, and it may be a problem in your country as well.
That was Eugenie Scott from the National Centre for Science Education on the line from America. Back here in the pod, we're of course joined by Lewis Walput from UCL. Lewis, Dr. Scott said there that there's a fundamental failing in our education system. Do you agree?
Well, a fundamental failure in the sense that the teachers don't really have enough understanding of evolution or of science. That may well be. I just don't know the nature of science teachers. I'm puzzled as to how much evolution is really taught in schools. It's quite a complex subject. And I'm not sure that unless you were well trained in the subject that you would be competent to teach it, let alone learn it.
Have you had any run-ins with American creationists yourself?
No, I had a run-in the other night on Newsnight with somebody from Truth and Science. And he kept on talking about this designer who'd fixed everything, and I kept on asking him who the designer was and what had added, and Fred, there was just nothing there.
Does anyone else in the pod have any final thoughts on this, Bobby?
Yeah, I was wondering, I mean, earlier on we heard Richard Bugg say that when who designed the designer was the question, and he said, well, that's a philosophical question that should be taught in religious education classes. And I thought Eugenie made an interesting point about the differentiation between the US and Britain with the separation of church and state. Even if you want to teach this in a British school, which, you know, is different to how you might teach it in an American school, why can't you just teach any of this in an RE lesson rather than in a science lesson?
I totally agree.
James, can you sum up our polemic?
Well,
somehow.
Well, my question to the intelligent design advocates is, the definition of science is that you can come up with a way of refuting your theory. Now, I don't see how you can refute intelligent design. You could start out by saying, I think the eye looks incredibly complex. I can't see how it could have evolved. Therefore, I think it's irreducibly complex. Now, we heard Simon Conway Morris earlier on saying that we have a very good understanding now of how the eye evolved. And they've moved on to other things like this bacterial tail, this bacterial flagellum. And now they say, well, we don't know anything about this.
So being opportunistic.
Well, the question is, if a couple of years down the line, evolutionary biologists say, well, we've got a pretty good explanation now for how the bacterial tail evolved. Where do they move to next? You know, they're kind of shrinking away into the margins. And, you know, you can never pin them down and say, well, what's the test of your theory?
James, just calm down slightly while Nell has her say.
One thing that seems to get slightly lost in these discussions is that whether scientific methodology is very clear how it works. And I don't think it is. I mean, there's a big debate in scientific philosophy of science about how you define science and whether, you know, refutation is a useful method. And I wonder whether it's worth examining that before kind of glibly
Certainly
chopping
not.
It out.
No.
No? Why not?
Please keep away from the philosophy of science. No, no sensible scientist that I know pays the slightest attention to it. The way science works is that you look at the evidence, you look at your theories, you try to persuade your colleagues. It's a group activity. It's not a single person working on their own. And you move forward. And if people can show that things are wrong or right, it's quite a complicated process about which the philosophy of science teaches us nothing. And to come back to intelligent design, it says nothing. It simply says it happened.
And agreed.
That's not science. That's religion. You should not link intelligent design with science. It has nothing to do with science whatsoever.
And with those sage words, we'll finish there. Thanks all. Well, that's nearly it for this week's show, but first some letters. Nell?
I've got a great one. It's from someone called, slightly surprisingly, Prawn Tot, but it makes some really good points. Sorry to hear you briefly criticise David Attenborough in your excellent podcast for not doing enough to raise awareness of environment problems. He's made two series focusing purely on environmental issues, which are always strangely overlooked by those who repeat this criticism. I feel this is the least of his contribution, however. I would argue that he has done more than any other living or dead person to raise our awareness of how the complex natural world functions, and thus enables us to have a better understanding of the full implications of climate change. Every one of his television programmes shows us just how much there is at stake simply by telling the story of the diverse forms of life on Earth and how they are all interdependent. By not constantly breaking the narrative by explanations of why the species we are looking at are under threat, Attenborough achieves so much more. My 4-year-old son loves his programmes too, and consequently will grow up with a strong understanding of why climate change doesn't simply mean we can enjoy milder winters. Not only that, but he sticks it to the creationists really well too. It's not for nothing that Richard Dawkins referred to him as possibly the most respected person in Britain. I do enjoy your podcast, though.
I like that. I like that last sentiment. Bobby, what's your letter?
Here's one from Ray Gosson that came in. Before I get to slagging you,
let me say that
I really like your podcast. So he says that occasionally you fail to grapple with the important issues, preferring, it seems, to glibly pass over some of the more troubling or difficult aspects of certain topics. I'm thinking particularly of a few stories on embryonic stem cells, where we hear comments along the lines of, yes, there are ethical issues, but the scientific potential is so great that we can ignore them. All that's missing, he says, is the maniacal mad scientist laughter. But then he said, good work, keep it up. So I don't know what to take from that. But
I blame James for everything. Well, I think you'll agree this particular podcast has been anything but glib. We've been going through all the ethical issues of everything. We hope you've enjoyed it. You can go to the website, guardian.co.uk/science/podcast, to listen to all our previous podcasts. And my thanks go to everyone in the pod, Nell, James, Bobby and Professor Lewis Wolpert. You can listen to a longer version of this podcast on our Creationism podcast Extra, where you can hear more from Simon Conway Morris, Richard Buggs and others. Just remains me to thank our producer, Ben Green. Didn't he do well? I'm Alok Jha. See you next time for another Science Weekly.
Guardian Unlimited podcasts in association with Zurich. Visit guardian.co.uk/Zurich Futurology to join the debate on how the world is changing and for your chance to win a Wi-Fi laptop.
Guardian Unlimited.